Welcome to Secondhand Film Critics, your favorite source for mildly pretentious, semi-uneducated, and highly unqualified opinions on movies. I am your favorite artificial intelligence NPC from your favorite game, and I am here with
Dolly Parton's wig, and we are here to talk about three films of all time that have been released with our good friend, returning guest, Peter Kohanek. Everyone, a round of applause.
No, please. Thank you. As a, many of you know me as your local transplant straight from Toontown. Really happy to be here.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the first time we've actually had a toon on the podcast. So. That's
right. Yeah, truly an honor. Truly an honor to have you here.
And this is a lot of pressure on you to really represent the toons.
We've been really trying to grow our like diversity, equity, and inclusion program.
For sure.
So we're really grateful for you, the toon, to fill that spot for us.
Yeah.
For the folks at home, my heart is beating just like inside of my shirt. Just with how excited and happy I am.
Oh yes, the heart shape coming out with your cotton.
Mm-hmm. With my cotton. Mm. That old phrase.
coming out with the cotton.
We love to see it.
This is another good old triple feature. Going to be jumping into three movies that you already know because you've read the title. But before we do that, let's talk about some of the answers we got to last week's question of the week.
The question.
We asked last week because we talked about the new Wes Anderson movie, Asteroid City. And so we asked our listeners, you, where should the next Wes Anderson film be set? Because, well, we've been in Texas. We've been in Texas again.
Everywhere from the American heartland to the American islands.
Yes, the submarines. We've been on a boat.
Topical.
We've been in Russia, right? Grand Budapest is Russia, right?
Yes.
Where in France, of course.
The desert. Asteroid City, we've been there. So we have thought, where should the next one be set? I vote for the moon.
You literally just read my mind.
Don't you think that would be great? Wes Anderson on the moon?
I think exactly. I think you take like a, you know, if you took certain scenes from 2001 A Space Odyssey and added like plucky strings in the back, you almost have a Wes Anderson type movie in terms of just the pauses and the time that is taken. Yeah.
I'm sure he loves 2001. I mean, every filmmaker does. But I feel like he, like, there's some shots in there, especially the way, like, the inside of the, I don't know if it's a ship or if it's, like, really, like,
the station, the space station?
Yeah, the inside, the way it's set up is a major
for sure.
Him vibes. Yeah.
The movement of the environment in that film, I feel like, is just waiting for someone like a Wes Anderson to play around and be just sort of, like, exciting and you know, thrilling, not thrilling,
yeah.
Enticing.
Well, Bryce agrees with you guys because he Wes Anderson should lean full sci-fi and put it on the moon.
Iconic. Wow. Bryce is on the same wavelength. I think it would be great. I would just love to see how Wes Anderson would design spacesuits.
Yes.
I just feel like whatever his spacesuits, I feel like it could be kind of a cross of like, you know, in the Guardians movie when they wear the
rainbow. Yeah, I was just
going to
say the Guardians movie.
That's probably the closest we've gotten.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to see that in Wes Anderson. So, you know, what else do we got?
Let's see the Film is Lit podcast, which Peter has also been on. This is really the cinematic universe of podcasts. We are
Peter Kohanek podcast
it's
network.
It's really the Peter, Peter's podcast network.
The Kohanek network. They said Wes Anderson should make a super spy movie and set it across the globe.
Okay.
I think that would be very neat.
That would be. And like, I think we're about to talk about kind of like a classic style detective movie. I think him trying his hand at like a detective style movie with like someone in the lead role would be really interesting.
Hear me out. Essentially a remake of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but with stop motion characters with live action people.
Interesting. I think you
at
could
least
pull it
one
off.
Scene, at least one scene, I feel like needs to be like an abstract stop motion scene.
Yeah, ever since Fantastic Mr. Fox, he's had some stop motion like in his movies at some right. point, you know, yeah. some miniature. So I don't think it would be like too far fetched.
No,
know?
I he don't likes think so to, either.
Likes to include that.
And then our final answer, Sandy said the Titan submarine.
Damn.
Which
that'd be a tough movie.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I feel like we could have even like a Wes Anderson. Where's our Wes Anderson like tragedy historical movie? Like Wes Anderson Titanic, Wes Anderson's Cuban Missile Crisis. Like
I feel like he would do something like that actually that was like a really tiny tragedy. Like a small town tragedy that no one's really heard of, but is actually like a real thing. Like if he was gonna set
Wes Anderson,
something off of a real event.
Flint water crisis.
Jesus. Well.
Yeah, I know he doesn't really, he doesn't dip into the real world a lot as far as like real world touchstones go to give you a sense of like, oh, this is where we are in the world. Because it's usually always kind of, even if it's a year, it's always taking place like in its own kind of separate timeline. In its own multiverse. Wes Anderson multiverse.
This is literally confirmed? My multiverse of madness. I've been on Twitter before. I Love Dogs was a sort of true story, right? Or it's based on a sort of, or it's based on a, the pier or the island itself was real.
I think there was like elements of like truth in there and like legends right. and like other things that he was pulling from there. That's true. And also Grand Budapest was based on the writings of some
J.K. Rowling
got like some guy. Yeah. J.K. Rowling, some guy that I don't know who I don't remember his name. It's like some Russian guy. But he's like credited as a screenwriter because it was like kind of based on some of his writings too.
Oh,
so
neat.
He kind of dives into some
he's
of that.
He's adjacent
but
to the real world, but it's never quite.
Yeah. Like asteroids, you know, asteroids are real.
And so are aliens.
Hmm. Yes, of course. And the moon.
Speaking of aliens, I was trying to tee up a segue that I didn't know how it was going to work. So, but
you were just expecting us to take yeah, to roll with that.
This is,
speaking,
this is your
I was
show.
Like,
you do this
I was
every week.
Racking my brain to like think if there were aliens that I missed.
Dolly Parton is out of this world.
I feel like Ryan Reynolds could be an alien.
You know what?
It's not confirmed,
if,
but I have my suspicions.
If Ryan Reynolds is actually like a real life AI generated like robot.
Yes.
Person who's like the first like test of AI implanted in a yeah. person in the real world.
I honestly, if it was ever going to come out that there was like an AI celebrity that like secretly was AI, Ryan Reynolds would be the one I'd be least surprised by. I'd be like, that tracks. I'm kind of surprised that we didn't figure that out actually sooner.
I had a real, and I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I had a real surreal moment where. A real surreal moment. It was a very surreal moment that I had in which I was looking up some behind the scenes stuff on that film that we will mention later. There was, while I was reading the interview with the director, a Mint Mobile ad with Ryan Reynolds popped up on the website and I wanted to scream. I was truly like, this is hell. This is it. This is the bad place.
Yeah, let's jump right in then.
Please.
To our triple feature. If anyone listening hasn't listened to one of these episodes before, this is something we like to do a couple times a year where we invite someone on, have them pick three movies for us to watch in some specific order. It can be based around a certain theme. It can be just because they like those three movies. Really, it is up to the guest to decide how they want to program and go about making their triple feature. So, Peter, do you want to just kind of tee up what we like the menu that is about to be served, the courses, the three courses? I don't know what I'm saying, but yeah, why
for
don't
sure.
you just dive in?
our agenda for the evening, our itinerary.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm happy to. So, I want to sort of talk about what linked these three in my mind, you know, sort of at the end, because it is really wild. I feel the three that I landed on, and I am so grateful to both of you for coming on this journey with me. But the three movies essentially are the film 9 to 5, 1980, I believe. And then Who Framed Roger Rabbit, 1988. And then finally, Free Guy, which came out...
I think 2021, right?
It came out in 2021. Originally finished in 2019, pushed into 2020. It was supposed to come out July 2020. Then that got pushed back to December, at which point in November they said, no, that's actually not going to happen. They removed, Disney removed it from their slate entirely. And then in December came back and said, okay, actually, it's going to come out in the spring of 21. And then in the spring of 21, they said, okay, August for real. And then I think it was August of 2021 that it finally came
August
out.
August 21st, yep.
That it was like hit. Such a wild time in movies. It felt like every movie, it was like, is this actually, is it really though? No
I feel
one
like
knows.
In Free Guy, this the trailers, even when I watch the movie, it gives off the feeling of like, maybe this is just a fake movie.
Yes.
And so what, during all those delays, I was like, do they have a movie
right
though,
like
or...
I don't think they actually wanted to ever make a Black Widow movie, but they just wanted to show that they were doing another female-led movie, and they were like, yeah, Black Widow's coming out, totally, it's still coming out, yeah. Obviously we're gonna make you pay for it on Disney Plus if it comes out, I mean when it comes out, but yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about that in particular, about Free Guy, and the, touching a little bit more on that. But yeah, there these were just three. I had seen 9 to 5 for the very first time recently. And then there was a bit of a free association link that I'll touch on near the end, that brought me to these other two in sequence.
I'm excited to get the reveal. Because I just watched all these three movies, and I'm usually pretty good at like finding connections and like themes and stuff, but I'm a little at a loss this time, so I'm excited for you to weigh in, I guess, and get your take.
I have a few connections we can get to at the end too.
Great.
Though.
Now I hadn't seen 9 to 5 previous to this viewing, as well as my wife Maggie really wanted to watch it, and I wanted to watch it just more like, oh yeah, if I see it, you know, I see it. But so we sat down and watched it. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. I had seen Roger Rabbit several times before. And then Free Guy, this was my very first time as well. What about you guys in terms of what you had experienced already? Obviously, Free Guy, you did the show on previously.
I don't even, did we do an, I think I just
you
watched
talked
it.
About it. You talked about it.
I think I talked about
it. You touched on it.
I don't think I made you watch
it. I had never seen
it.
This was the first time I had watched it.
Great.
So, because you, I think we talked about it in one of those, like, what we watched episodes. I had not seen any of these movies. So, this was first time watch on all three movies for me, which is fun.
Usually, we have, like, some kind of preconceived notion about the movie, but...
Yeah. So, this was fun. So, do we want to jump into the first one, 9 to 5?
Yeah.
Sure. Let's jump in. So 9 to 5, we have a synopsis here that, Kayla, did you find this on, it says on IMDb by the user Peanut Lee.
Yes, I pulled all these from IMDb
General
users.
Peanut Lee.
And I did have to trim out like a couple sentences to kind of make it not so long.
We should sing the song as a synopsis, actually, I think should be
it.
Our real synopsis. That's it. Okay, so I'll read this one, and then we'll get into reviewing 9 to 5. Meet Franklin Hart, the biggest sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot boss on the planet. Long exhausted over his gruesome bullishness, Violet, alongside co-workers Dora Lee and Judy, comprise comical methods of doing him in when a freak incident occurs. They then manage to kidnap Hart and trap him in his own house while assuming control of his department, and productivity leaps. But just how long can they keep him tied up? I guess we'll find out in the movie. I feel dun, like dun, so dun, many dun, 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 1980s, 1990s movies have like this, like the main like selling point, right? Where like the selling point in this movie is like they're gonna kidnap him and then they're gonna take control of the office. So many movies around this time do that, where they have like their selling point, but then it doesn't happen till like the end of the second act. Am I the only one that feels that way?
No, this movie was super like it was very much just like what's going to happen? We're going to wait for everything to come to a head.
Which is, I think, is an interesting shift where now the setup of the movie is, or the thing that's going to draw you in, they have to give you like so soon on, like right. For Free Guy, which we'll talk about, like the thing is like he's an AI, he's an NPC, right? And they jump right into that, right? But with movies like this, sometimes they take their time in getting to the thing you're waiting for, which is the kidnapping and then taking control of his building.
And streaming, it makes it so easy to just stop watching something. And I think that, you know, if you don't catch people early now, they're going to stop. They're going to turn it off faster.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great point.
See, Pacific Rim Uprising, which I don't think I've ever done in my life. I was physically unable to finish that movie.
Wow.
And I brought it back to the library. I was so damn upset.
Support your local library, folks. Shout out to the libraries. So, Peter, this was, you'd seen this recently, I guess. Do you want to,
yes.
I know you talked a little bit about it, but do you want to kind of touch on a little more why you picked this one and what you like about it?
Yeah, so, I mean, phenomenal film, just insane, insane movie that, like, really went in places that I did not expect based on just my general cultural understanding of this movie. I knew, you know, that you had like, you know, your Dolly Parton, obviously, you know, has the title track, and apparently she signed on agreeing to it as long as she got to do this main track, 9 to 5. And but also Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin being these icons of, you know, more progressive media. And seeing the story unfold is just crazy. Just how much it really tackled. It's crazy because it feels like it's tackling these themes of like workplace harassment that as somebody who's still under the age of 30, I think there's a sense that movies didn't deal with stuff like this until the last 10, 15 years. And it's like, oh no, they've been trying to call attention to this for a very, very, very long time. It just hasn't actually, unfortunately, had the effect that it's needed to have.
Yeah.
To bring, you know, actual accountability to executives and people in positions of authority, because most businesses you go to where, you know, you're going to be told, well, that's just how it is, or you need to leave if you're not really comfortable with how this terrible person is interacting with you. But also just like how ballsy it is with like showing them getting high, being three married women in 1980. And I guess Lily Tomlin's character isn't married, but, or at least we don't see that she's married. Oh, and then Jane Fonda's divorced.
But she has like a family though. She's like supposed to, I guess, in the world's eyes be seen as like settled down more.
Single
like,
working mom, to... settled.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Yeah. But yeah, just very much like, oh my God, what? Wow, that's really neat about how it doesn't really paint anything that they're doing while high as like severely negative and like really like harmful. In fact, the consequences of sort of the story are only when they're sober and unable to handle the stress of their actual reality. So that's just interesting. And I appreciated that. It's also just insane to me how little happens for a very long time in this movie. Kind of what you were speaking to, Noah, where it's just like things are just sort of taking a long time to establish the world. And then all of a sudden, everything opens up and goes to crazy town so fast. Where it's like, yeah, it's insane that they had this person tied up, but it never really feels not real. And so that was a particularly striking thing where it's like, yeah, even though a lot of this stuff is like really like zany, all these things that are happening of them kidnapping the boss and then tying him up and then making this elaborate, you know, Ferris Bueller style mechanism to keep him in bed. But also caring about the fact that he like needs to eat and like they want to be like decent people to him. It's just so crazy how grounded it still feels in a lot of places.
Yeah.
Also just, I mean, the way that it addresses, you know, labor and the fact that really the arbitrary rules that are inflicted on the working class are only meant to make the powerful feel in control. And that you can actually, obviously it's not like a documentary, but you can increase productivity and employee happiness. And that will actually make people want to be where you are more. And so it was just really nice to see something that's so quote unquote old be so upfront and honest about that in a popular movie. And it's really unfortunate that a lot of these things, these lessons, haven't been able to be learned because of those.
They didn't actually like, you know, like it feels when you watch it, you're like, oh damn, like why does this still feel so on the nose?
Right. Like I'm still dealing with these things in different jobs. But
I mean, this is like a very, very famous movie, you know, like it's a very popular movie. It's not like it's one that just kind of was like a back burner movie either.
Right. But clearly taken by sort of that post boomer mindset of like, well, we don't actually have to do anything about it.
Oh, yeah, of course not.
Right.
It's like, just a movie. Like it's just a silly comedy.
They're so right. Oh my gosh, that's so funny. That's so, they're so right about all that stuff. Anyway, time to go back and put up with the monotony that is my job that I won't actually do anything about.
Exactly.
Which is just like insane, I think, as more, I think, millennial and Gen Z attitudes are being shaped towards like, no, we're willing to work for this reality. What happened?
Yeah, I think I'm surprised. I feel like this movie could make a comeback for that reason. It's very timely in that way. I love these movies, like 80s, 90s comedies that are supposed to be for a mainstream audience, but have a real sense of voice and actually something to say.
Yeah.
It's like one of my favorite styles of movies. So you like this and then like Tootsie, Plane, Trains, and Automobiles, Election, Groundhog Day is like a huge one. Like they have like all that same feel of like that mid to late 80s, early 90s. Kind of film grainish look,
chaotic, zany characters interacting. What about Bob? Sort of like,
yeah. And if all of them are also like about real people in like actual situations that you could, and it's like more situational comedy in that way. And then they're able to touch on actual big ideas and themes in this mainstream comedy.
Yeah.
So this kind of movie is right up my alley. I thought the performances and like the chemistry between the three leads was incredible,
off the charts,
and really what is like the reason to watch it. And there's a lot of moments of like real surprise. So the synopsis mentioned when they come up with these different ways of kidnapping the boss or like whatever, but like in their head when they're getting high. And those are like the scenes that they could have just kind of, they could have easily cut those or made them a lot less interesting than they were.
Yes.
But they really, like, each of the women have their own fantasy scenario and they are all really specific. So you've got like the black and white kind of shot and like they're all shot differently. One of them is something that we'll see coming up in our next movie with like real animation being put into the movie, right? Animation and real life kind of combined. So there's a lot of things in this movie that also just point to the fact that the people that made this really cared about it and they really wanted to make a really good movie. And I think they did. I think this is a great movie that holds up not only in the themes, like you said, but also I think it's just still really funny.
I think something Sorry to Bother You really wouldn't have existed, where something that could get so existential and crazy that we're able to have in the current era.
Yeah, that'd be a crazy double feature. This and Sorry to Bother You.
Honestly, the working class explosion, like you just having this idea of exploitation in the workplace of what's deemed as necessary in a workplace. I think this movie definitely, even if it wasn't able to have the sort of ground shaking effect on U.S. labor like you would want it to, it definitely created a clear presence and market for stories in this vein.
It gave us a kick-ass song too,
of course,
you know.
Yeah, we got a song out of it.
When will we bring back movies that their title, they have like a theme song that uses the title's name, like Avatar Way of Water? Why can't we get like a theme song that says Avatar the Way of Water?
Who would do it? Who would you have do
James
that
Taylor.
Theme song?
Okay. It's the way of water. It's the way I am.
And even like, I mean, the movie that just came out that I thought was really good and kind of gave me like that feeling of an older like 2000s movie that maybe would do that was like No Hard Feelings. Like, why can't we get like someone to do a theme song for No Hard Feelings that's like No Hard Feelings? I don't know. I just feel like we are really missing out on the movie theme songs these days, and we need to get back to it.
I think people wanted studios and films wanted to emulate the John Williams and Giacchino's, and well, the Giacchino is sort of like an offshoot of that, but like movies became so obsessed with like replicating a specific cinematic score.
Yeah.
That like at this point, it's like you couldn't tell me, or I couldn't, you couldn't tell me. No, I couldn't tell you what is a Avengers theme versus like a Flash theme or something. Like, I could tell you, oh, probably this belongs to one of these types of heroes. But right. I couldn't tell you, like, and with very limited exceptions of like WandaVision or like Moon Knight, which was like a very specific sound.
Yeah. Loki had a really good score. So there's exceptions, but I think there's such a fear of being seen as like cheesy or, there's a fear of sincerity is really what it is. And so having cheesy, maybe like kind of corny theme song that is fun could be seen as like it's too vulnerable. I think there are a lot of filmmakers or like films feel like they have a much like greater distance from the material, and it's a lot like less personal feeling. It's a sign of the times, just like Harry Styles said.
You're so right, bestie. He was so right, shall I say.
He was so right.
He's a sign of the times. I'm Thanos' brother. It definitely, I think, of the late 90s, early 2000s, when that shift from title track to this was going to be in the movie, but instead we want the Oscar, so we're going to put it in the credits, sort of started shifting. And then I think the Academy's put in a rule that you have to have a certain amount of the song in the actual movie for it to be considered.
But they still do it at the tail end. They start it with the, like, the scene. Like, specifically, I'm thinking of, like, in Top Gun or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Don't they start it, like, they start it when he gets on the motorcycle or whatever the fuck they happens at the end of that movie. And it then
rides
it
off
goes,
in a plane.
Yeah, whatever. And then it goes into the credits, and it's, like,
wild.
Lady Gaga ballad, and you're like, man.
But then the one that should have won is the one that was a little bit more like hard on its sleeve, which was the volleyball. What? Not the volleyball. This is the football.
The football scene.
The One Republic song.
That
and that's
one
like
probably could have actually won.
It's a shame. It's a shame when that stuff gets shifted around purely for that kind of marketability.
I think they play 9 to 5. At least twice in the movie,
I think
they?
I'm pretty sure they play it twice. They definitely play it opening credits.
And end credits.
And also, there's like that montage when they're like making the changes. Do they play it during that? I think it's one time during the movie.
Yeah, the honk, at the very least, they do the honky-tonk sort of piano sound the bass underscoring a lot of moments. But so ultimately, this movie... When they brought out the animated segments of Violet's, you know, ponderings of how she would torture her boss, I was like, oh my gosh, like this is a lot deeper or a lot more like production value than I thought was going to be in this. And then my wife looked it up and was like, this is 8 years before Roger Rabbit. And I was like, oh my gosh, because it's not like... It doesn't look as good as Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but definitely it's a better version of this integration, especially because it's only being used for a bit. It was pretty impressive for being a side gag.
Exactly. That's what it was impressive for something that was like could have been a throwaway scene.
Yes.
Like they went that hard on it.
So that sort of was like got me thinking back into, oh yeah, I want to watch Who Framed Roger Rabbit again soon. Let's just do that. And just thinking about the value that, you know, was clearly shown as throughout the 20th century of the integration of animation and live action, and really the fact that they were capable of doing these things in both films without computer generated tracking and systems that really you know, all this stuff is being done by hand. And yeah. So that was sort of my connection there that got me thinking from one to the other first.
Yeah, that was when I saw that, I was like, okay, well, that's definitely a connection right there is the animation. So with that, do we want to jump into the second movie here?
Sure.
All right. So this is Who Framed Roger Rabbit, as most people probably guessed by now. Kayla, do you want to read this synopsis?
Sure. Yeah, imagine like this whole time we're talking about Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and then we're like, okay, let's move on to our second movie, which is The Godfather. Like
Part 3.
Okay, this synopsis is by Jay Welch of 5742 on IMDb. Down on his luck, Private Eye Eddie Valiant gets hired by cartoon producer R.K. Maroon to investigate an adultery scandal involving Jessica Rabbit, the sultry wife of Maroon's biggest star, Roger Rabbit. But when Marvin Acme, Jess's alleged paramour and the owner of Toontown, is found murdered, the villainous Judge Doom vows to catch and destroy Roger.
Wild. So, Kayla, you hadn't seen this. I hadn't seen this. Obviously, I hadn't seen 9 to 5, but this is the one that was, I think, I was obviously aware of this movie more. And this is one that I had been wanting to see. So it's always cool when we can get one of those marked off by doing a podcast episode, you know? Always wanted to see it. And now we're going to be talking about it because it's obviously a big movie, like you kind of were alluding to, in the history of animation and late stage 2D animation, hand-drawn animation before the move to fully digital.
So this is both of your first time seeing this.
Yeah. I think this is one of those movies that like you obviously know about, but if you never watched it earlier, it's kind of like I've had it on my watch list forever. Like, oh yeah, I should watch Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
You kind of assume you know like the whole story.
Yeah, you just never like take the leap to put it on. It's just one of those kind of movies until that usually happens with this podcast is like there'll be one of those movies that's been sitting on my watch list for 5, 6, 7 years. And then it's like, oh, yeah, we're going to do an episode on it. So it just happens.
Great. So what'd y'all think about this time?
I thought it was really good. I mean, I was pretty sure that I was going to like it. I think there's a lot of people that I like usually agree with on Letterboxd have it rated pretty highly.
I appreciated your review, your one-liner review.
Oh, my one-liner review. Yeah. I mean, with that, like I think that this is like a miracle that this movie was made, not just because of the animation. Like, obviously, like I can't imagine the amount of work that went into all of that.
Astounding.
It's crazy. But like, this is today would be such an unmarketable movie.
Yes.
This is made. This movie could only have been made in 1988 with just the subject matter that they were discussing. Like, it is under the surface a very adult movie, you know, not just because of like, oh, Jessica Rabbit, a sexy rabbit. Like,
welcome to Watch Mojo's top 10 pause moments in animation.
That's also like what Space Jam, guys. All right, so same thing. But I think,
is it Noah? That's just interesting that you thought that was similar in that capacity. But all right, go on.
For me growing up, it
very
was
very specific,
right?
Pull. My attraction to Lola Bunny has never been on the record, and so I'm gonna keep it that way. But you do what you want to do. Yes, I want to marry her. Yes, I want to marry Mira Nova from the Buzz Lightyear cartoon. Don't worry about it.
The Buzz Lightyear cartoon. But even just like the whole, like, there's a lot of violence in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
There's the motivation of the villain is because he wants to build a highway. Like, just a lot of more just what you would expect more in like an adult film. I think it's crazy this movie was made, and that's one reason why I like it a lot. Is just I love that it exists, but I also thought it was a very well done like noir style movie with also like Looney Tunes characters as well.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I thought it was like very funny. It's refreshing, I think, to see movies like this that feel, obviously, this has been out for a long time, but feel very like fresh in what they're doing, even like all these years later. I can see now watching it how much this like likely influenced a lot of movies that followed it. Space Jam for one.
Mm. Oh, for sure.
Looney Tunes back in action, like stuff like
that.
One
of my favorite films of all time.
I love Looney Tunes back in
classic
action.
Classic movie. It really another is. Movie that. Another movie that I'm surprised was, I don't know if they can market today as much.
I thought about
Looney's.
Picking that one for this.
I loved that growing up. But yeah, like, just, I don't know. It's cool to watch something sometimes in that context, even on a first watch, to sort of watch it and kind of have little slots fit into place where you're like, oh, I can see where, like, this influence said thing or whatever. I was surprised. I mean, I knew it was going to be funny, but I was like surprised at how many little things they were able to do just because of the bandwidth of the animation.
The jokes per second in this movie, even with all the technical things it's doing, is astounding.
Yes. Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
And like
a lot of jokes.
We've had a conversation recently where these Disney live action remakes can't include a lot of humor because of the way that animation provides like a very special type of humor with the way characters interact or the faces they make, expressions, all that, their movement. And I think with this, that made it very clear where it's like we have live action situations, but you just cannot replicate how funny cartoons are. Like, because just inherently, like Roger Rabbit, the things that he does or the facial expressions he makes, and like, you just can't, you can't do it any other way. And it, that's
no
what makes it so
good. In real
good.
Life is going to be able to replicate that same level.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that that's something that I like really appreciated about it is the way that they didn't just throw the characters into this movie, that like the way the characters like actually took up space in the movie and really like felt like a part of the world, even though they were like not the same type of character. I don't know. It was very cool. I was very impressed with their ability to translate the interactions of the like live action space and the in the cartoon.
Yeah. And one of the biggest parts of that, and I did a lot of I did my dissertation on it, but I did a certain amount of research, because, and this is something that like I've a movie that I've just been, that's fascinated me both as a fan of animation and of comedy for many years now. And I've known a couple of these things before, but by and large I took it upon myself to look up, you know, just a couple more in-depth explorations of this movie, and I wish I had all the things to cite in front of me. But one of the biggest focuses of the film, it, you know, in what you're saying about how much it feels like they're actually interacting with it, is the work they've done with eye lines. Because if you look at a lot of the animated live action integration before, you know, particularly like with Mary Poppins, that's a very popular example that's used. Popular example. When she's in this animated world, Julie Andrews is looking up and down and around and looking at things, and you can very clearly see that there is this it's almost like you can tell that they're on a different plane than the actual animated characters, because all the animated characters look like they're on a glass plate in front of everything. Like, you can very much see that this is something that is being added in later. So with this movie, the animation director, who was somebody by the name of Richard Williams, that's right, who was a Canadian animator who supervised the animation sequences and who had to be kind of convinced to do it, because he said, you know, look, ultimately these kind of things always look really hokey. So if you're going to want to do this right, there's going to be a couple of stipulations that I have, which is like the eye lines have to be tight. Another one was that all the characters have to be animated in the sort of 2.5D style, where you're going to be able to tell the shadows of everything. Everything's impacting each other. You're seeing more of the shapes, you know, up to five or more layers of animation of each cell was hand drawn, because of course this is pre-digital, to show where these characters are moving and how the lights, the physical real life lights, are interacting with them. There's a scene where Bob Hoskins bumps his head on a lamp and the lamp is swinging around in a circle, and you can see that it's affecting Roger in every single frame of that scene. But with the eye lines, there is a certain intentionality that, because they filmed all of the live action first, they took the rules that were applied to keep the proportions consistent, where the animators would then intentionally create situations or expressions that the animated characters could use to then adapt to where that eye line actually was. So in a scene where Bob Hoskins is looking to the side, where Roger is like sliding along a wall, because Bob was looking higher than Roger's eye line, they had Roger up on his tippy toes, because his character model wouldn't have been where he was looking. Or when he's looking above his bed and he's looking forward, they had the Roger model lift up his hand and point to his face. And so all of a sudden, Bob Hoskins is looking at the finger that's being pointed at him. And so you're, as the audience, we're subconsciously going like, oh yeah, they're in the same room.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, also, that's crazy.
A lot of technical direction or creation that they made, where they made physical objects that would have like an almost like robot like quality, where when he's throwing the dishes, they had actually had a little like robot guy that was like a stick with arms lifting up and throwing dishes, so that the actual physical props could be moved and then they could animate over that.
Yeah. That's so cool. I need to watch, like, I watched behind this today, so obviously I didn't have a lot of time to, like, get into all that, but I definitely was like, oh, gosh, I need to, like, look up some cool behind-the-scenes stuff of this, because this seems like the kind of movie that just has so much to the technical side of it that I can't even imagine, like, some of the behind-the-scenes and, like, how they accomplished everything they accomplished.
And it really paid off. I mean, it not only was, like, you know, well-received generally, but also it made, I think, twice to three times the amount of the budget. Originally, it was bought for about $30 million, or it was said to be that eventually it was recorded that it went up to $70 million. Although Disney was like, yeah, no, the highest we went on this was $50 million. It's like, come on. But Jeffrey Katzenberg, before, of course, being scorned and creating DreamWorks, really pushed this movie to be like, look, this story in this form has the opportunity to totally save our animation department. And because this movie was so successful on all fronts in 1988, The Little Mermaid would then be created through Disney animation, starting the Disney Renaissance. So it's, while it definitely is not as remembered as those, it's still kind of astounding that something like this really did the work, and it paid off. Because the studio would not, right, like you were saying, Noah, this would be such a hard sell.
But like you said, I think it's been cemented as like such like a cornerstone of the Disney animation in their transition, I guess, like you said, to the Renaissance, because this was a tough time for them. The 80s. Right. So this is a big, this is a big transition movie, and it made its money back and more, which the studios always like. So it did.
I mean, and it's lasted too. Like, I mean, I feel like this is one that you wouldn't feel like on its surface that you would see people rewatching a lot or still talking about just based on what it is. But like I feel like I see people watch this quite often on Letterboxd, like either people rewatching it who love it or people coming across it for the first time, like us watching it. Like I just feel like it has this strange longevity to it that you wouldn't expect for this type of movie too, which is really cool and just like speaks to how good it actually is as a movie and not just like something Disney happened to make that like succeeded. Like it actually was something that was crafted well and has that lasting power to it.
And it also really set the stage for, you know, the modern, the aforementioned Multiverse of Madness. The fact that Steven Spielberg, while he didn't really have a lot to do with the actual production of the film, he was the one who really, like, because he was, like, so much of a blank check guy at that point, in Hollywood, he was the one who was able to convince Warner Brothers and Paramount and Universal to lend people from their stable of stars, so to speak. Are you guys familiar with the Bugs Bunny Mickey Mouse deal?
No.
So basically, because Disney, you know, produced it with Amblin, Warner Brothers said, "We'll give you Bugs Bunny, but he has to be in exactly the amount of frames as Mickey Mouse." And so the reason why they're in a scene together instead of being just sort of separate, and the same thing, I think the same deal was similarly applied to Donald and Daffy, but they decided to just put them in the same sequences together. So they were like, "Look, that way we don't even have to worry about like timing it right with other scenes."
Yeah, that's so interesting.
That's a smart move. And I think the use of IP in this movie is really right where it should be.
Yes.
I think they do a really good job using the IP as like it get you invested in the world and really flesh out the world. But the main characters that you're seeing over and over are, at least in your, if to us, not IP. I know this is loosely based on like a book, so I guess Roger Rabbit was like created before this. But for us, it's like these are brand new characters,
right?
More or less, right? And so, and that means we have not, there's no like other attachment we have to them from other things. We're coming to them completely fresh. And all of the people that we recognize or the properties we recognize are just like the icing on the cake that really flesh out the world and kind of legitimize it. Like, okay, this is really like all of the cartoons live here. It's not just like all these knockoffs of other things that we know, like Mickey's here, Bugs Bunny's here, like all the greats are here. But I think it's good that the main characters that are actually like progressing the story and are on screen for the longest are people we don't have attachment to.
Right. You get to develop your opinion and perspective on who they are based on what's happening in the movie.
Yeah. If this was Who Framed Mickey Mouse, this movie would just not work because right. Like you have too many preconceived notions of Mickey Mouse.
And letting it be free to sort of exist, being able to exist in this shared world. It's like nowadays, like in what we're about to talk about, Free Guy, and like the Chippendale movie, it's like...
Chippendale movie reminded me of this in a good way, I guess. But.
Right, exactly. I watched some of that movie and then was like, okay, I'll come back to it another time. Whoops.
Yeah.
The second time I've said it, I've only done this once. But the use of IP also, it's not very cynical. It's also very celebratory of the history of the medium. And ultimately, it's not because one company owns all of them.
Yeah.
And it's because, and I think that's part of it, is because they had to be collaborative and they were forced to be like honoring of all these different things. Where like, you're not punching down to the guy who your own studio actually cast as Peter Pan and then treated like garbage for his legacy for 40 years and then punching his dead body in the gut by making him a main bad guy in your sequel for the Chippendale movie. Like it's not taking the opportunity to punch down on anything. And in fact, the drunkard hungover guy is able to find healing because he is able to see this world of collaboration and that it's bigger and there's something to serve outside of yourself. He is shown as the hero, not because he overcomes those things, but he overcomes those things because he knows he can do better without them, which is just so like it didn't feel preachy that he puts down the bottle. You're actually like excited for him.
Yeah, I think this, like you said, the celebratory, I think, is the key word, where if the whole movie feels like a celebration rather than like they're doing it to fan service or bringing in people. It's very uncynical. To me, this movie reminded me more of like Smash Brothers and less of like Chippendale. Like Chippendale has like the usages of the intellectual property and like bringing in all these characters. It felt like that, like more like a celebration, like you said. Yeah, and Chippendale, it feels so, that movie just as a whole feels so like nihilistic. I don't know. It's like one of the worst movies of all time.
It's so sad. Like, it's so like, why would you choose to take this thing that is this form that's very much valued by children and adults because everyone's been a child, and say any part of it has to be a certain way? or saying, oh, well, this stuff can be celebrated and this stuff we can be like winking a nudge, like, you know, oh, well, that's you. We all knew that was a euphemism. Whereas it's like everything in this movie that's euphemistic is like is treated with a certain sincerity, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I think sincerity is also a really good word to use as we transition to the third and final film. One of the most sincere films I've ever seen.
Truly.
Free Guy from 2000, like we said, 2021. So jump, like, these other two movies are pretty close, only 8 years apart, but now we're jumping to the future, to the NPC AI world of Free Guy. Peter, do you want to read this beautiful synopsis, who was written by Nick Riganaz, and then also edited then by Kayla? So
thanks, Kayla. Thanks, Nick. Brimming with optimism and positive energy, single bank teller Guy has spent nearly all his uneventful life wishing he were one of the cool people wearing sunglasses, people who run his town. But one day, Guy has a chance encounter with mysterious Millie, the woman of his dreams, and just like that, Sex of the City style, he's on the brink of making an eye-opening, life-altering discovery. Now, to win her heart, all that Guy has to do is to take control of his life one step at a time. And then, out of the blue, Millie decides to drop a bombshell. However, is she telling the truth? Above all, if life is nothing but a game, what will it take for an ordinary guy to level up and get the girl?
What will it take, indeed?
Nothing. He's not real.
So, as we established, I had seen this movie previously, but
yikes,
you two had not. And I know this is also a movie that has a lot of opinions about it on the internet. So I'm interested to see maybe like how your first viewing experience was of the film Free Guy.
Really, I mean, truly just, you want to talk about like sincerity and like just a sense of we are making this because we care and we want to tell this story instead of we have an idea and we want to make it into a 2-hour film. This film was really just a pitch meeting that then they said, well, we got a couple set pieces, let's run with it, and then just have CG added in later. And obviously I'm exaggerating, but
this movie looks so bad, though. It's like it one of the ugliest movies to look at.
Oscar nominated Free Guy for its VFX.
This movie was already in production at Fox, 20th Century Fox Studios. And I think one of the earliest trailers I remember seeing, because the Disney Fox merger happened in 2019, I believe, when it was starting to near the end of its production. I remember one of the early trailers and seeing this movie, and this is a post Deadpool and Deadpool 2 world, and thinking, man, this actually has a chance to be something kind of cool and like cynical in an intentional way and be more of like a criticism and like.
I thought it was going to be cool. When this movie was first announced, I was like, oh my gosh, like, video game world, awesome. I love this. Like, it looks funny. It's got people that I like in it. It's going to be good. And then, like, it came out and I never went and saw it. And I had been, like, looking forward to it and talking about it pretty much since it was first announced. And then it would, like, once it was getting closer to, I was like, like,
every
I don't know.
Every time it got delayed, the marketing got a little more diluted, I think. And, you can tell that the film itself, like, there are, what, I think there's only one F-bomb in it, but, like, there's a couple GDs, couple S's, like there's really, like, quite a few choice words, curse words in it that, like...
This should have been an R-rated movie. Should have been R-rated.
And you're sitting there asking yourself, like, this sounds like they were saying this a lot more. And it sounds really awkward just the way it's slid in there.
Well, and there's moments where it's like, I feel like they're that in the script that was like a worse word. And then it's like, oh, well, obviously they had to pull back on it there. It's like, oh, they said crap instead of shit. Like, obviously that was a choice by the studio. Like, you guys can only say shit like 3 times. Right. And that's it.
I wondered it, too, in some of the like violence sequences as well. like within the game. I was like wondering how much they pulled out of the violence that like might have originally been there.
Yeah. Because they, I was reading about it earlier, how Sean Levy and Ryan Reynolds were also working on, I think it was it Adam and His Boy? Is that the name of it?
The Adam Project.
The Adam Project, yeah. Right. Which seemed very much more of like a family, Adam and
it
his
is.
Child.
It is more family friendly.
That was like very clearly in the marketing crafted to be a family friendly experience. And I think this was sort of their chance to do an original take on some where you took sort of all the lessons that were learned through Deadpool of like Ryan, even like the surface level things of like Ryan Reynolds funny and Ryan Reynolds say funny quippy random things and make something kind of neat. But it's gosh, I read this one interview, I think it was with IndieWire, with Sean Levy, where he was like, I studied gaming culture for a whole year and always had gamers and people who loved games in my writer's room and surrounded me. And I'm like, yeah, you can tell that you studied gaming culture for a year because people are saying like, get his ass, noobs. Like, oh, he's such, you know, also Keys. Does anyone have a real name? Anyway, the whole time you're like, I was talking to friend of the show, Caroline Roberts, about this earlier. Who else? Enjoyer, lover of IP and content.
Fellow enjoyer of Free Guy, of course.
Casual enjoyer.
Casual enjoyer of Ryan Reynolds,
of
for
course.
Sure.
Biggest fan. Lin-Manuel Miranda, number two, Ryan Reynolds.
Number three, Jimmy Fallon.
Jimmy Fallon, top three.
Top three men.
What's even funnier is that Caroline and I literally had a conversation this morning about Jimmy Fallon and Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Amazing.
So. They are the same breed of
they
person.
Really, it truly is. Someone who is like genuinely talented and then something changed and then their luck, like the Zoltar machine, like powered down.
Another person in this movie, Taika Waititi, is also one of those people, in my opinion.
Like, yes. Yeah.
The
and
golden
in this movie,
child.
I don't think I laughed at one of his lines in this
He's
movie.
He's horrible in this movie.
Ew,
genuinely.
So unfunny.
And like, I was a Taika fan. I can't say I'm not a Taika fan.
Yeah,
at this
I'm not
point.
Totally unsubscribed, but yeah, same.
But when I was watching him in this, I was like, oh God, I'm kind of like embarrassed to claim myself as a Taika fan watching his performance in this.
And you can tell that like all the riffing and stuff in Ragnarok and. Well, you can see it very clearly in Love and Thunder, but this is sort of when it's starting to be like, there needs to be a script and an editor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that they took all of those things. And then when it suddenly had to be repeatedly pushed back for whatever reason, you know, I have no idea what the specific reasons were. I don't know if anyone will really know besides those directly involved why it had to be this almost finished movie had to be keep pushing back. Other than, like, we want to make sure we have as many eyes on it as possible. Like, I mean, really, like, at the most marketably feasible moment to release this. And I think that it's one of those, you know, flash cases where it's like, we just keep pushing it and pushing it and pushing it and keep reworking it. Mm. And it's like, ultimately, the studio has sunk so much money into it that it can't not release. So it's gone through so many changes that anyone who has ever made anything knows if at some point, if you're writing an essay even, and you have to keep writing and changing your arguments and like really digging to find evidence for your argument, you need to take the other argument because you're not actually finding the evidence for it. At one point or another, you've got to admit this is not the right story we need to be telling.
Yeah,
I think this movie to me is like such a disappointment. I mean, because I see so many good things in this movie that are something, so many things where they could have taken a different route.
Yeah.
But there's just like some element of just like, you can feel like some studio control around so many different elements of this movie. And there's like so many choices where it's like, oh man, if they'd only like lean into this more. There's even a line that Joe Keery says, Keys, where it's Thank like you. Trying to advocate for like original stories and like original storytelling,
right?
And it's such a funny, ironic line because in this movie it feels like this movie is not can't decide whether it wants to advocate for that argument, like, oh yeah, original stories, original ideas are great. Like, that feels like what they want to say. But then there's also all this other stuff where it's like, is that what you want? Because then we have, like, Ninja on screen for, like, multiple seconds. Jacksepticeye, the Captain America Pokemon. Shield. Like,
oh, so speaking of IP, if I can launch off of yeah. that. So in this IndieWire interview with Sean Levy, they were kind of like, so how were you able to, like, because he was kind of like framing it like, well, we were able to, like, make fun of these big studio projects while actually being paid by them and, like, having a thing. And, like, they were like, how did you get that under their noses?
I don't think that's what they did.
No, and absolutely not. And he was saying that, like, well, we were, you know, going through production and, you know, we had the script and, like, all of a sudden we were aware of this Disney thing. And so, like, I sent an email to, like, Bob Iger and a bunch of other Disney execs and we're like, hey, can we use some of the toys in the toy box to, like, use in this film? And it's like, you can't pretend. Oh, and then his sort of thing was like, but we wanted to wait until the third act to really make it, like, worth it. Like to have the payoff and have the thing.
Of course.
Like, you cannot act like this movie was free, couldn't depend on that until you were allowed and then were able to add it in post or reshoot things and put it in later after the rest of the movie had already been decided.
Yeah.
Like, truly, like, they have the Mega Man, because he was like, oh, we didn't want to just totally do it like the Lego movie or Ready Player One, where it's like just like IP all over in your face. Like, we don't want to do that. And it's like, well, I don't think you could. And you weren't allowed to do it and really have a real critique. Otherwise, you would have committed to it. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you would have made knockoff versions or joke versions of these things with the audience understanding.
If you want to really satirize the thing, you can't actually use it. You have to include, like you said, like obviously you're referencing the Captain America shield, but it's something different.
If they could use the Half-Life gravity gun that looked almost exactly like the gravity gun, but they couldn't use a real portal gun, what was that about?
Oh, yeah. I was like, okay. So this movie, to me, it's a very conflicting film because there's so much about it that I don't like, right? And, like, so much about it that feels like the opposite of what I like in movies and want to see more of, you know? Yeah. Like, I definitely don't want to be seeing a Free Guy 2 anytime soon, if ever.
Speak for yourself.
Free Guys.
I think they're making a Free Guy 2.
God, they must be.
Don't ruin my day like this, please. but there's something about this movie where it's like, I feel like this was Spider-Man 3, where I can see so many things where it's like, man, that is actually, like, a decent idea, or I really like this approach. I think the whole, if they had leaned more, they should have leaned so much heavier into the core relationship at the center of the movie, which is the two game developers. Because I think, like, the thing with, like, him programming, like, Guy to have, like, the personality of her.
That's a
like,
that whole reveal idea.
At the end, fantastic. Why wasn't that the thing?
Can we talk about them being across the street from each other at the very end, and her like seeing him across the traffic and him like being like, what?
He's like, what the fuck are you doing here? Like,
and then she just
face
like
was wild.
So
I was
funny.
Like, okay.
And then she just like kind of like tilts her head and he's like,
oh,
are we doing this? And she's like, yeah. And he's like, oh. Huh. And I'm like, what got cut here? What happened? They just decided the movie's over. We need to have them get together, but we can't schedule them on the same day to be in the studio. So they need to have this wordless interaction. Oh, I felt like I was going crazy.
I just think that it could have been so much better. And it isn't. It's just a very it's a very mediocre, forgettable.
It's a
movie.
Bad version of the Lego movie.
That's
Mm-hmm. It's a Disney. Yeah.
If only Chris Pratt was in Free Guy.
I've always
come
said
on,
this.
Guys.
That would have been the linchpin there.
The missing element.
That would have been it.
If Chris Pratt was in this, who would he be? Would he be like Channing Tatum?
He'd be Guy. Channing Tatum was great in this, by the way.
He was. Channing Tatum crushed this role.
He gets put into cameo roles really well, and I want to say it's just him picking things well, but that can't be true.
Bullet Train, he's so funny in that movie.
I'll take your word for it. I don't want to sit for 3 hours to see that. So, but I believe it. I believe it. Like, he just shows up, and you're like, and he just plays like a silly, goofy guy.
Yeah, I think of him in like that one movie we watched, where he did that dance scene.
Magic Mike. It's just Magic
the
Mike.
The one where he did Magic that, Mike. Like the sailor. What movie was that? We talked about it with Bryce.
Oh. The Coen Brothers movie. Hail Caesar.
Yes. Like something like that. Like we've talked many times about how I am a converted Channing Tatum fan. Cause I used to be a hater and now I'm a fan. But it's because of stuff like this that is like, has made me a fan because I had watched growing up his like silly rom-com phase, like where he was not good as like that kind of main character. But then I see him in stuff like this and I'm like,
this blows my mind.
I'm like, this is the guy, this is him. And he's perfect. And yeah. I think he was great in this. I think that's another thing where, like, if they had really leaned into the, like, rated R kind of aspect of it, I think it would have really increased the humor in this movie and stuff like that. I think they could have done a lot more with it.
And it would have felt more subversive, too. Like, this doesn't, it feels, it's too clean to feel subversive.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think there's a lot of things, elements in this movie that I did like. Mm-hmm. And I think there's also a lot of people in it that are, like, great. I mean, apart from, like, Taika, I think, like...
Jodie Comer in this movie, the same year as The Last Duel. What a double feature.
Wow.
But yeah, I think, like, everyone gave good enough performances for, like, what they're working with, too.
Yes.
But it's just, like... I just feel like it really, this could have been a movie that I would have like really loved at one point in time, but it's just missing like the it factor. Like there's just something there that's not there.
Even the concept of them wanting to create this, like, because it doesn't, it's unclear if it makes a, it's trying to make a comment on film. Or in the film industry, or it's trying to make a comment on the video game industry. And I think it becomes apparent that it's about the movie industry or the entertainment industry, if you want to call it that, where it's like you have the opportunity to make a real criticism of the video game industry and have it be more specific in a lot of ways. Like literally what they were doing with the first game being totally deleted and the second game being the
Overwatch
only
question mark.
The movie could have been so much more.
Yeah. And they touch on like things with like crunch time development.
Right.
Like they could have really
these are
dove
real
into
things
that
have happened in the real world since this movie came out in a non-ironic way.
This could have been the 9-to-5 for the video game industry. This could have been the video game industry's 9-to-5.
It is.
I think that's the biggest thing about this is it, there are things about, I mean, I was entertained the whole time that I watched it, like whether or not, it, you know, I watched it with my dad and he liked it and laughed at it and stuff. And we were, you know, having a good time.
Shout out to Mark.
Thanks, Mark. He laughed out loud. I will say when we talk about IP, I don't think he laughed out loud the whole movie until Ryan Reynolds pulled out the lightsaber. And he, like, laughed out loud when the lightsaber came out. And I was like...
You know what? We got him.
We got him, boys. We got him.
It worked for Mark. Works
but
for me.
I don't know. I just think, like, it is... It's one that you watch and you say, oh, well, that was, like, a good time watching that one time. But it's something I wish, like, would have been, like, a favorite of mine from that year. Or, like, something like that.
I would rather have lightsabers and Fortnite gliders and axes and Hulk hands the entire time instead of just like this weird condensed payoff.
Yeah.
As if it was like predicted or, you know, foreshadowed the whole time.
I think there's also, last thing I'll say, there's also with this movie a newfound layer with the more recent advancements in AI and the fact that like the lead character of the movie is like an AI main character who is like has zero flaws and is like the best. I just think it makes it feel a little more cynical, even though I know that's not like the message they were trying to send,
right?
But like
it's almost like you wish that was actually intentionally the message they were trying to make.
Yeah, it's just like it feels a little weirder now to me because like AI feels a lot less of a like a science fiction concept.
Right. And one of the things that Caroline asked me when talking about this movie was, did it feel like an AI like wrote this movie? And without missing a beat, I said, yeah.
It does.
If especially the scene when he jumps for the wrecking ball and then Miley Cyrus's wrecking ball plays, I'm like, that would be an AI idea. Like,
but wouldn't that be crazy though? If this movie was written, but like the level that would add if like you're like, actually we wrote this movie with ChatGPT.
Maybe Free Guy 2 will be written by an AI.
I don't doubt that it could be. Anyway, I know we got to wrap up. If I could transition to tying these three together.
Yeah, please do.
Of course. Yes, please. Somebody explain this madness.
Someone
this
explain.
This multiverse of madness, if you will. that's the only kind of madness I have these days. So I'm an improviser and an actor and performance artist. I fart too loudly down the street too sometimes. One of the guiding principles of staged improvisation is the idea of A to C thinking, where you have a concept or an idea that's maybe it's dropped in a scene, or you'd play a game at the beginning of a show to generate ideas. And then through free association, you go from A, which is something that's spoken out loud in the scene or in the generation. And then that free association makes you think of a B, which is connected to that A, and then that B makes you think of something that leads to a C. And that C is what you actually say then as inspired by A in the actual scene. So what the audience is seeing is you creating this extemporaneous thing, which really you're just thinking two steps farther from what they've already seen. So while it's still, well, it's a brand new scene or a brand new concept that's then performed on stage, the sort of magic of it is that it's still inherently connected somehow in one of the player's mind to that original idea. So you can create this ongoing cohesion through this fundamental. And that's really what happened here, I think, where the A was 9 to 5, which brought me to my B, which was Who Framed Roger Rabbit, through just through the animation element of it, the live action animation, which ultimately the idea of using IP in a really intentional way versus a very like utilitarian and very like cold marketing heavy way, you know, just even on face value. And I think you could plug in a couple things in here. You could have plugged in Roger Rabbit or not Roger Rabbit, Rescue Rangers or Ready Player One. Or
yeah. I'm glad you didn't make me rewatch Chip and Dale, though. So thank you.
Yeah,
thank
no
you
problem.
I would much rather watch Free Guy again.
Absolutely.
That might have been the first time we ever like veto something. We've never done it before, but we might have. We might have. I might have been like, that's just not going to happen,
too
Peter.
Much.
Sorry.
It's too far. I'm not asking you to watch like Pink Flamingos or something. Like, no. The Chip and Dale movie is too much.
The Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers, that and Bohemian Rhapsody are two vetoes.
Those are the two vetoes. Won't do it.
Yeah, that was sort of my thought process on it. And ultimately, I think all three have interesting things to say about, I mean, any American cinema at its heart can be drawn to its critique of, you know, the treatment of the working class. But it really does have a lot to say about how people are treated in business relationships and how the seeking of capital is ultimately a soulless and really void of creativity venture. You know, the only thing that's gonna get this character money in Who Framed Roger Rabbit is by, you know, making sure that Toontown is destroyed for the most amount of things, which ultimately is a commentary on the modern use of freeways and him saying like, oh, traffic will be a thing of the past. And it's like, ha, that's very funny. It takes 4 hours to go 3 miles in LA still.
Yeah, right.
And then, you know, in 9 to 5, it's I think even more surface level of, you know, you exploit your workers for the sake of just, you know, nudging up to people above you. If they're actually going to be individuals, they're going to be happier and they're going to do what you really would want them to be doing anyway, more easily and more willingly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, finally with Free Guy, as heavy-handed as it is, you know, Antoine, Tyga's character, his pursuit of capital and getting rich and having all this power and influence and control really just corrupts this really cool thing that is created by people with passion, but not the money. And ultimately, though, if you can get other people to understand how just how valuable your thing is, you're going to find that solidarity is unprecedented to anything else than the biggest corporation can buy and sell somebody.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing for me, when I was like thinking about these movies, the free guy is honestly like the world that Judge Doom kind of is talking about a little bit with like the whole free. So I think the biggest knock on Free Guy is that it would be Judge Doom's favorite movie of 2021.
Nice. Zing.
Zing. Kayla, do you have any final thoughts?
No, my main thing that I had seen between the three was like someone basically like taking down the big guy. Like,
yeah. Oh yeah.
Like, just the man. Whoever it was, it like, man. You know, Keys and Millie taking Antoine down in Free Guy, and then
Free Guy, notorious stick it to the man energy.
I just think like, wow. No, I just think that there is, that was pretty much the one thing that I was like, I pulled this one, I got that one. But yeah, I think that overall, I enjoyed watching, I mean, regardless, I enjoyed watching all three of these movies in some way. So I think that that's a win either way. And I did watch them almost in a, I watched them like 3 days in a row. I watched one, two, three. So I was able to kind of, you know, have more connection or more thought process. But I think it's clear that we can have similar conversations about all three movies, regardless of whether or not there is a through running theme. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we can pull similar things from each of them, which is cool.
Yeah. And they're all streaming. So you two at home can recreate this triple feature.
Yeah. Huh. Wow.
Wow. What should our question of the week be?
If you, in the last year, which movie do you feel would have benefited the most from a hit, from a charting title song?
Okay, in the last year, which movie would you have given a title track? That's a great question. I mean, Glass Onion already had one.
Yeah, I was going to say, Glass Onion didn't need it.
Rian Johnson's already one step ahead of the game with that one. I feel like, you know, Bones and All could have used a really cool title track just right over the scenes of them eating each other. You know, that would have been real cool.
I'm going to say, I was originally going to say Banshees of Inisherin.
That would have been so
because
funny.
I just think that would have been, if we had had like a nice little Irish jig.
We don't know where we're going, but we know where we've been. We've been in the middle of living in sin. We're brothers, we're sinners. Inisherin. Inisherin.
I'm going to say, pull out of pocket here and say The Black Phone.
Oh,
I think that could have used like a fun song.
You know, I think Nope. I feel like Nope was missing that.
I feel like, you know, what would have been great for Nope, like a good like Western song, like a really good like old timey Western number.
Hmm.
Would have been fire.
I think See How They Run could have benefited from something like that, too. Not that specific genre. But
See How They Run.
See how they run. See how they run.
I mean, I guess the series that does do this still is the James Bond series. So shout out to James Bond for keeping the tradition alive.
Yeah.
That's true. They do. They do that.
They do that. So question of the week, just reading it through one more time just so everyone gets it. In the last year, which movie would have you have given a title track? You can answer that on Spotify if you're listening there, on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter, if it's still around, if it's one of your 600 tweets that you're lucky enough to see. It's all in the show notes. So reach out to us there. Peter, do you have any socials or anything you'd want to plug?
Yeah. So definitely follow me on Instagram at the real Peter Kohanek. That's Kohanek as in Kochanek, which is where I will You'll find me in any sort of updates that I'm doing and also just random malarkey that I'm up to. You can also follow me on Letterboxd. I'm on Letterboxd now.
You are.
I'm a man of culture.
Joined the cult.
Finally. Which you can follow me at because I'm PK.
Nice.
And you can see all of my thoughts there. I don't post a lot of reviews, oftentimes, or ratings. I will oftentimes do, sometimes I'll write a little blurb if I have something particularly funny to say. But you know, just wanted to make sure I was keeping track of things and definitely writing things down a little bit more than I had.
It's very helpful. Helpful.
I've seen 49
for sure.
films this year, which is just crazy.
Look at that. Cinephile Peter.
That's right.
So yeah, we'll put all that in the show notes as well, so everyone there can check that out. Next week, we are continuing with the third of four episode in our summer of Twilight.
Are we doing Breaking Dawn in one part or two parts?
I feel like we can do it in two. I thought we said one.
Okay.
So maybe there'll be five episodes.
I couldn't remember.
Why would you rob the people of an extra episode?
Why would we rob the people of an extra Twilight episode?
Why would we rob Ert Pattinson, the people? This one will be
canceled.
Eclipse. So the third film.
Why don't you watch the whole movie? You're just going to watch Eclipse?
I can't get through it all.
Oh, I was so close.
I actually think I'm going to watch this tonight because just like knowing like the time of stuff I have going on this week. So might be watching this one tonight and then we'll record an episode on it and have that out next week. So you can hear our thoughts on Eclipse. I'm excited. Are you excited?
I'm very excited. I'm trying to finish reading New Moon and then I can read Eclipse. But these books are so long for no reason. They're like 600 pages.
My wife has just read through all of them for the very first time.
I'm reading them for the very first time as well. So, and this is all both of our first times watching it.
Not a plug, but it is my wife Maggie's birthday today. So happy birthday to Maggie.
Happy birthday, Maggie.
We got to get Maggie on the pod sometime too.
Listen, I've always said this.
Let's do it. That's our show, though. I think that's pretty much the gist of it. That's all, folks, as they say in the cartoon world. With that, then, thank you all for listening. And until next time, I am actually Ryan Reynolds as an AI.
And I'm the rat poison in the coffee.
And I'm a instant hole in a box.
And we're your second-hand film critics.